Coming up next on The Exchange, legislation at the State House has been moving fast, cutting budgets, cutting ties, and possibly dismantling state workers' collective bargaining system. House and Senate Democrats are raising concerns about the bill.
It's disappointing to see what is happening here. We are gutting it, and the reason? Really unknown. But I'll tell you the compromise. We're compromising Iowa's future with this legislation.
We'll also look at the opposition to Republican efforts to standardize the minimum wage statewide. Opponents say it could hurt workers in counties where the wage has already been raised.
And you would see the legislature electing to take money out of workers' pockets. I think that's a terrible idea.
That and more coming up on The Exchange. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appear to be considering a non-two-state solution in the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. At the White House a short time ago, the leaders told reporters they expected a closer relationship than what the U.S. had with Israel under the Obama administration. President Trump was also asked about an apparent increase in anti-Semitism in the U.S. since his election. He responded with a recap of his election victory.
Well, I just want to say that we are, you know, very honored by the victory that we had, 306 Electoral College votes. We were not supposed to crack 220. You know that, right? There was no way to 221, but then they said there's no way to 270. And there's tremendous enthusiasm out there. I will say that we are going to have peace in this country. We are going to stop crime in this country. We are going to do everything within our power to stop long simmering racism and every other thing that's going on, because a lot of bad things have been taking place over a long period of time.
On the issue of settlements, the leaders signaled possible differences there. Israel wants to continue with settlement construction in occupied West Bank territory. President Trump says he would like to see the Israeli government hold off for a while. New York State's Attorney General is warning immigrant communities to be careful of con artists masquerading as immigration enforcement agents. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports a fraud alert was issued after reports emerged that scammers threatened to detain immigrants in New York City.
New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says his office has received more calls about scams since the recent deportation raids around the country. In Queens, one immigrant was approached by four men. They were dressed as agents with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and said they would arrest the immigrant unless he turned over all of his money. Schneiderman says immigrant communities should remember that ICE agents will never ask for money and that agents must have a warrant signed by a judge to enter a person's house. Other scammers are trying to extort money or personal information from immigrants by phone. Schneiderman says people looking for immigration help should only work with a licensed lawyer or service provider and avoid signing any documents they don't understand. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, New York.
The CEO of Under Armour is reacting to protests from celebrities and other critics who were angry when he told CNBC last week that he believed President Trump was an asset to the country. In an open letter published in the Baltimore Sun today, Kevin Plank says the company stands for equal rights and job creation, and Plank says Under Armour does not support the president's travel ban on refugees and immigrants from several Muslim-majority countries. This is NPR News. Thousands of production workers of Boeing's South Carolina plant are voting today on whether they should unionize. If yes prevails, they'll be represented by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. The Associated Press cites labor experts who say the outcome of the vote at Boeing could prompt similar votes at other sites across the South, where they say states have long been able to lure new businesses with the promise of limited union influence. General Motors is in talks with the makers of Peugeot to sell GM's European division. The Opel division has suffered financial losses for years. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports the move could prepare the way for a larger merger.
The PSA Group owns the brands Peugeot and Citroën. The company said in a statement that it's considering, quote, numerous strategic initiatives aiming at improving its profitability and operational efficiency, including a potential acquisition of Opel. Both GM and PSA said there can be no assurance that an agreement will be reached. Opel is GM's European business that has helped the company compete design-wise, but losses have hurt GM's bottom line. A sale of Opel could clear the way for a potential merger between GM and Fiat Chrysler. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
Higher spending at restaurants and gas stations in January accounts for an overall jump in retail sales. The Commerce Department's out with a new report that finds retail sales picked up at a seasonally adjusted 0.4% last month. Not as strong as the month before, when retailers posted a 1% increase. The Dow is up 88 points at 20,593. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Moo, offering businesses of all sizes premium business cards, postcards, and stickers with options like gold foil, thick paper stock, and rounded corners. This is You by Moo. Learn more at Moo.com.
Currently 39 degrees in Sioux City, 28 degrees at the Iowa Great Lakes at 12:06. Good afternoon, I'm Mary Hartnett with a look at Siouxland Public Media News. Both chambers of the Republican-controlled Iowa legislature are continuing the debate this morning on a bill that may gut the collective bargaining system for public workers in Iowa. It would also change the way their health insurance works for most workers. Last night, Democratic lawmakers succeeded on pushing back scheduled votes on the bill. The House chamber debated the bill for several hours last night and decided late to adjourn. The Senate took similar action. Democrats now in the minority have filed dozens of proposed changes to that bill. This morning, Democratic Senator Todd Bowman from Jackson County read numerous emails he's received from constituents who are public workers who are worried about the effects of the collective bargaining bill. One of them was a longtime teacher and administrator from DeWitt, Iowa.
During my time in education, I also served as a chief negotiator for our local teachers' bargaining unit. I cannot express how valuable that process is for the health of our school district. It is also incredibly invaluable for our profession. I see that from both sides now.
The House and Senate in Des Moines are continuing the debate on collective bargaining at this hour and will continue for most of the day. A bill giving state lawmakers control over refugee settlements in South Dakota will get its first hearing in a Senate committee. The Senate State Affairs Committee today will debate a proposal to prohibit new refugee settlement agreements in South Dakota without prior approval from the legislature. The proposal would take some responsibility away from Lutheran Social Services of South Dakota. It's the state's only resettlement program. When the bill was first proposed, the organization didn't take a stance, but officials say the group regularly communicates with local officials and the governor's office and works directly with the Federal Office of Refugee Resettlement to place refugees in the state. The bill is backed by a group of Republican lawmakers. And now we'll take a look at the forecast.
From the KCAU 9 Weather Center, we have an update on your 7-day forecast. Sunny skies today and very pleasant conditions with a high of 52. Weaker winds from the northwest turning south at about 5 to 10 miles per hour. During the overnight hours, we'll have mostly clear skies. It'll be a cool night, a low temperature of 29 with southerly winds at 5 to 10. Tomorrow, sunny skies and a high temperature of 60 degrees. West and southwest winds at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Looks like we'll continue to have sunshine into Friday, a summer-like day with a high temperature of 67, pretty close to the record high temperature of 71 degrees for Sioux City, which was set back in 1981. Then on Saturday, we'll have mostly sunny conditions. It'll be slightly cooler as the wind turns to the northwest. We'll have a high temperature of 58, mostly sunny and a high of 63 degrees on Sunday. On Monday is when we have our next chance of precipitation. We'll have mostly cloudy skies and a 40% chance of rain showers, a high temperature of 65 degrees. And then on Tuesday, mostly cloudy skies and a high of 62. I'm meteorologist Scott Larson for KWIT, KOJI, Siouxland Public Media.
It's 40 degrees in Sioux City. And at the Iowa Great Lakes, it's about 30 degrees at 12:09. Up next, stay with us for The Exchange. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Iowa's minimum wage has been at $7.25 an hour since 2008. Four Iowa counties have initiated their own minimum wage hikes. Now Governor Terry Branstad says he would support a moderate minimum wage increase. State lawmakers will debate the proposal this week. The bill would allow the state to roll back minimum wage increases that are already in place. Sioux City Democratic House Representative Chris Hall says Republicans and Democrats do agree on the need to have a statewide minimum wage to stop the county-by-county patchwork of different wages.
And that's something that you find Democrats and Republicans mostly agreeing on. There is an element of local control and a lot of county boards who have looked at increasing the minimum wage because it makes sense for their county. But the bill that has been proposed right now would actually create a uniform minimum wage across the state at $7.25. And that creates a lot of issues because it actually would reduce wages for workers in the counties that have already approved an increase. So if you live in Linn County, Johnson County, Wapello, or Polk, and that is a large share of the state's population, workers in those counties might actually see their wage decrease, and you would see the legislature electing to take money out of workers' pockets. I think that's a terrible idea, and what a lot of Democrats have pushed back in the last couple of days to say is, if we are going to have a uniform minimum wage, let's also increase the minimum wage. It only has the potential to do well for Iowa workers, and also it is the right and responsible thing to do to make sure that we're not, depressing wages for a large share of our state's population.
That was Sioux City Democratic State Representative Chris Hall talking about the minimum wage bill that's expected to be debated by lawmakers in Des Moines this week. While Hall welcomes a raise in the minimum wage, a lot of business owners in Iowa and members of county boards and chambers of commerce disagree, saying the higher wage would make it hard for them to stay in business. Republican Matthew Ung is the chair of the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors. Ung says raising the wage is not the best way to help workers have a better life.
On the minimum wage, I'm opposed to raising it just for the simple reason that I think job growth and competition is the way that you grow wages. You reduce taxes, you increase economic development. But if it is going to be changed, I think most people agree that it should come from the state house. So in that regard, I'm happy to see them discussing it. In Woodbury County, last year, we were under a lot of pressure to set up our own committee and then possibly increase the minimum wage on our own. And when we didn't, we were called racist idiots and bigots by Sioux City Councilwoman. So there was a political price to pay for that. But I think it was the right choice because if you look at, House Study Bill 92 that you're probably going to be talking about, this legislation preempts all local government from increasing the minimum wage above the existing state wage, and it also rescinds the increases that have recently been passed in four Iowa counties. So if we were to do this last year or this year, we would be on very unstable ground legally, and I think it would be in the worst interest of our citizens.
I think that in the counties where they raised the wage, the idea was they thought they'll raise it, then the rest of the state would come up to where they were, but that doesn't seem to be the way it's working out.
Right. That's been kind of a piecemeal approach that the state legislature does not like, is that, those counties didn't necessarily agree on how fast or how far they should go as a group. So you have these different minimum wages all over the state, and that makes it very hard for businesses and especially interstate businesses to understand and to plan for. When we discussed it at the county level, I said, that I don't support it just for the reason that, nonpartisan government, watchdog organizations like the Congressional Budget Office in years past estimated that, if Obama's 10-10 per hour was put in place, then over half a million jobs would be lost in 3 years nationally. So it's really a philosophical debate rather than an economic one. I think the economic debate is settled. But again, I think if it is going to be changed, it should come from the state house. And if if the counties want to discuss it, I think it's just a needlessly political issue that should be discussed at the State House.
That was Republican Woodbury County Board of Supervisors Chair Matthew Ong. While many business owners are also opposed to raising the minimum wage, Ben Kneffler of Kneffler Chevrolet is not one of them. Kneffler says he supports raising the wage.
We don't currently have anybody at minimum wage. I think the lowest hourly rate we're at right now, I think it just went to $11. And for us, it's more of an investment in the employee and ultimately the customer. We feel that at a higher level of pay, we're providing a better job, and then the end result is a better experience for the customer.
What do you think it is that makes people afraid to raise the minimum wage?
I suppose that if you raise minimum wage, that your obviously your labor costs are going to increase, and in a lot of businesses, the same with ours, the labor cost is oftentimes the biggest expense. For us, an investment in that expense is a good investment in the business. So there's a return on that, and I can't speak for other businesses. In our case, the return is worth it. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that obviously if you're paying more out, your expenses go up, and depending on how the business is run and what the margins are, that could affect the business, and I could understand that.
Governor Branstad has said that he would support some kind of small increase or graduated increase in the minimum wage. Do you think that's a good way to go about it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of hesitant to weigh in on the political aspects of it. I'll tell you this, that if you're selling something, and somebody walks in, that's making more money, then your chances of selling something are better. So, for me, I always gauge it like, could the people that work here afford to buy our product? Because if they can't, then to me, I'm not selling Porsches or Mercedes or really high dollar vehicles. We sort of as a community, we want the folks here to be able to go out and to be a part of the community, buy into the community, and that kind of thing. So if that increased, I don't necessarily see. I think you were talking about $8. Is that correct?
I think so.
So 75 cents over 40 hours is not a ton of money, and I would imagine that the amount of money that would give folks. I think a lot of that's going to go into just basic living things, and I think that benefits the community. We see a livable wage as being both important to the community, and then also probably as importantly, it's an investment in what we're doing as a business.
That was Ben Kneffler, owner of Kneffler Chevrolet in Sioux City. You are listening to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Another big issue at the legislature this week is collective bargaining. The Iowa House and Senate began debate on Tuesday on a bill that would eradicate most of the collective bargaining rights for public workers. Republicans sponsoring the bill say it will allow local control and put taxpayers back into the driver's seat. However, Polk County Democratic Senator Joe Bolton told the Senate Tuesday night the measure fails to honor the compact that Republican Governor Robert Ray set up more than 40 years ago when he signed the collective bargaining bill.
It's disappointing to see what is happening here. We are gutting it, and the reason? Really unknown. But I'll tell you the compromise. We're compromising Iowa's future with this legislation.
That was Polk County Democratic Senator Joe Bolton talking to the Senate Tuesday night. Sioux City State House Representative Chris Hall says it may make sense to make some small changes to the state's collective bargaining agreement, but this bill goes much further than that.
The system works, and maybe there are a couple of tweaks or improvements that can be made to it, but completely gutting the system and taking away the ability for workers to have a say in their health care, to have a say in what their retirement benefits and packages look like, and also to take the rights away from workers when all they're asking for is a seat at the table. It's just unheard of, and it comes off as very ideologically driven. It comes off as kind of a political retribution rather than something that is thoughtful public policy. And it's hard when you push legislation like that and you're taking rights away from a huge share of the state's population. It's hard for them to understand why it's happening. And I think that it shows a huge disconnect between legislative Republicans, Governor Branstad, and the people who elected them. This isn't something that Republicans campaigned on, and to come out with a bill that is so ideologically driven and doesn't have any footing in sound public policy, it has people questioning what their motives are, and it has a lot of lawmakers feeling very upset, like this is something being funded by, you know, Koch brother money and out-of-state interests, something that has nothing to do with Iowa workers in the first place.
That's what I was wondering. You know, where it all comes from, and you have some small groups come up and say, yes, I support it. But a lot of them reference a study that was done back in 2011 that compared the business practices of this collective bargaining unit and the unions and the private sector, mm-hmm. and saying we have all these inefficiencies and you shouldn't have that and you'd save a lot of money. But then I believe the Iowa Policy Project came out and said, you know, these public sector workers, they don't make as much money as they would in the private sector, but they like the stability and the benefits.
I would encourage people in rural communities to think about how challenging it can be sometimes if you have an open teaching position or if you have a position for the DOT for a snowplow driver, how challenging it can be to keep the local economy in some of these rural areas thriving. How hard it can be to attract qualified and competent teachers to keep your rural schools open. And if you make it so that these jobs aren't even competitive, if you depress the wages and drive them down, if you tell these workers that they're going to have less health care and retirement benefits, that they won't have a say in what their employment looks like or even have a seat at the table, it's going to be harder to keep those rural communities alive. You're not going to be able to attract workers to them. One of the most important things to point out is something that the current chairman of the Republican Party of Iowa said in 2008 when he was a legislator. At that point in time, he said collective bargaining was a bipartisan effort. It was something that was created with input from both parties. And if the minority party doesn't have input now, if the people who are most affected by legislation have no say in the process, there's something significantly wrong. The Republican Party chairman said that when he was a legislator, and it is disingenuous for Republicans that served with him to be pushing this now when they know it really, again, has no sound footing on public policy. This is just a politically motivated issue.
That was Sioux City Democratic Representative Chris Hall talking about the possible effects of the collective bargaining bill currently being debated in the legislature. Woodbury County Sheriff Dave Drew is also concerned about the possible fallout from doing away with collective bargaining in Iowa. Drew was down at the Statehouse last week speaking out against the bill. Drew says since its inception in 1974, the collective bargaining system in Iowa has worked well for public workers and the state.
It's been an effective way to negotiate. I have had the good fortune to be a part of most of my career on the other side, which I call the other side, the deputy side of the bargaining unit. And, you know, we discuss pay raises or insurance, or people get really caught up in that. But what we also discuss is maybe wearing and safety apparel, maybe how many deputies we think we should have out, or numbers, a minimum staffing number. That's where the management team and the deputy team would sit down across the desk and discuss these things and have good open dialogue and negotiate things. And so later then when I was elected sheriff, being a part of now the management side of it, I sit there and, you know, quite frankly, I hope they get raises because it's the people that I support and I work with. So whatever they get, but I have no control over that. That's decided by the board or whatever. If this, it would be the school district decides that. But I want to hear what they think they may need or what may occur. Like, for example, our guys would work holidays, Christmas. So they have negotiated over the years an overtime rate that the board agreed on. Those are all sat down and bargained with. That's what makes Iowa good, I think, is that Wisconsin isn't the model program. Iowa collective bargaining has been the model program for 43 years, and that's why it should remain that.
Dave Drew is the sheriff of Woodbury County, but he spent many years working on the labor side of law enforcement. He spoke about the possibility of getting rid of collective bargaining in Iowa. You're listening to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. A living wage and a fair deal for workers has always been a concern for Lance Morgan. Morgan is the president and CEO of Ho-Chunk Incorporated, which is owned by the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska. Morgan has worked for years to create opportunities for the people in Winnebago, but he's also created a very successful commercial business. He started out in a working-class family and ended up at Harvard, which was a bit of a culture shock.
Somebody asked me, what does it take to go to Harvard or something like that? I mean, it's not something you just sort of decide to do, like your senior year of college, you know, or high school. I said, I didn't know it, but I had been preparing for it my whole life, you know, just in terms of working hard and reading and that sort of stuff. But to answer your question, you know, when you go from sort of a poor kid, and I lived in maybe the hood in Omaha, you know, and my father was a roofer, and when you go from that kind of environment to Harvard, you don't go being meek. you go with sort of an aggressive personality. And I remember I got a bad grade in one of my classes, and I came home from Christmas my first year, and my parents had it on the refrigerator, and it was circled. And I thought the whole thing was hilarious as far as they were concerned. And then when I came back at Easter, it was still on the fridge, except more people had added notes to it. And so it was humbling, to be honest, but I adapted to it pretty quickly, and just to be around, and I see the people now, right? You know, one became the president, you know, another one's about to become a Supreme Court justice. One of my professors is on TV all the time and was a senator, and so it's just that kind of crowd, and it's fascinating to go from that environment, and then you sort of move back to Sioux City and Winnebago too. It was quite a shock to come back here, to be honest.
Tell me a little bit about how Ho-Chunk started.
Well, I was actually the tribe's lawyer. They hired me, and we had a huge dispute on the gaming with our management company. And I was supposed to renegotiate the contract, and they sort of did something stupid. They wanted to arbitrate our ability to regulate. And we had a letter from the federal government saying, hey, we had to get them licensed. And they refused to be licensed. So they put us in jeopardy. And we ended up having to remove them from the gaming operation. And that, at the same time, Iowa reduced the restrictions on gaming. Used to have to be like $5 every 2 hour, $5 a bet or something like that. And so gaming became very lucrative for a very short period of time for the Winnebago tribe because they hadn't built the boats yet in Council Bluffs and the new boat hadn't come here. And but we knew competition was coming. And I joked that I was so cool that I wrote a paper in law school on alternative development structures for tribes. Yeah, the ladies really, they ate that up. And I said, hey, I have this idea for a tribal corporation. And I took the beginnings of it was my third-year thesis in law school. And I added what I'd learned as a lawyer. And that's where Ho-Chunking came from, just the concept of sort of separating the business from the politics, because that was always the problem with tribal governments. You know, it's a local governmental body. And running a large business, you know, with elected leadership, you know, it creates a variable environment that is not conducive to success long-term in business. And so we set up this structure, and we've won awards for it, and other tribes have copied it. But it allowed us to sort of minimize some of the negatives And that being a tribe in business has a lot of positives, and we added a little bit of the extra capital we got over that couple years before the boats came, and it was kind of a recipe for success.
Ho-Chunk is an interesting, you do regular housing, you've got housing you're working on in South Sioux, you have housing you're rehabbing in downtown Sioux City. You also do things with and for the tribe. Now, how does all that work together? It seems like a whole lot.
It looks like a lot of things, and there is a lot of things, but the tribe has various advantages in business. We don't pay federal income tax, which is a big one. We can't be sued, right, which is very helpful. We have sovereign immunity, which means we can't be sued. We have to waive it all the time for business purposes. We don't pay state income tax. We don't pay capital gains tax. We pass our own laws. And so if you look at Ho-Chunk, what it really is very clever ways to use those advantages. We also try to fill in sort of economic gaps. So we don't just have a gas station. We have a fuel distributor because that creates jobs. We don't just sell cigarettes at our gas station. We actually have a factory that makes them on the reservation and distributes to other tribes all over the country. And so we're trying to create an economy, and we base it on some sort of advantage. And so one of the things we've done, though, is those advantages make us nervous. You know, they've been a great way to sort of accelerate, but anything we've ever had has been taken away. And so we made the choice about 3 years ago to diversify into hard assets like real estate, because it wasn't based on a contracting advantage. It wasn't based on a tax advantage. It's just something that it would be a hard asset. And we never had the money for that sort of development before. But as we've grown, we're putting it into long-term investments. And we call it sort of the 100-year plan. Now, my board of directors made fun of me a little bit. I said, we're going to buy all this land and do this real estate because it's harder to take away. And somebody said, oh, no, they'll never take our land. And I said, well, we've got more lawyers now. but that's what we're doing. And we're doing the exact same thing that we've done in other areas. We're going to build a project in South Sioux, and it'll have houses, it'll have apartments. But we own the housing company. We own a modular manufacturing company. We'll own the apartments long term. We're an owner investor in Keller Williams, so when they sell the house, we'll have an ownership. We own part of Liberty Bank and then another bank called the Native American Bank in Denver. And so we'll make money on all of those things. So our goal is to sort of create this perpetual sort of motion economic development machine that creates job and income for a very long time. So we're heavily investing in the real estate now in Sioux City because we think we can long-term create assets. In Winnebago, it's a little bit different story. You know, we're an entity that is part socialist. You know, we're capitalists off the reservation. We're a little bit socialist on because that's the way we think. You know, it's not, these aren't strangers. These are family members. And so we figure out ways to build housing inexpensively. We charge less rent. We give down payment assistance to tribal members. And I'm not talking like $5,000. It's up to $65,000 to build a home if you're willing to commit to living there and building up our society, then we will help you in every way possible. We sell lots at cost. We sell the houses at cost. We do everything we can to sort of make our lives better, educational opportunities, jobs, everything. So, you know, we're sort of the opinion that we're on our own. People used to drive by in the community and sort of drive. They said, you didn't want to stop there unless you had to. And they would sort of look at the place and feel bad. But that didn't buy us dinner. That didn't put food on the table. That didn't get us educated. And that didn't give us homes. And so we've used sort of an aggressive corporate structure to create the income, to create an environment where if you're ready for success, we will give you that helping hand.
It sounds like it's really paid off in education and home ownership.
Yeah, we did an economic study a few years ago, and we went from 9 college graduates when we started to over 100 in our community. Our poverty level has dropped. Our income has grown at twice the rate of the other areas. Now, we're coming off a very low base. Our community, though, is primarily low-income housing. And so the base of our community is probably our poorest members. And so that can create, as you have rapid change in a society, you know, you have winners and losers and have and have nots. And we're not a have and have not society. We're a have and share with everybody sort of society. And so as we create this sort of move towards capitalism, it creates animosity within our community. And I'm not a universally popular, I can tell you, because there's some people who think that, you know, we've been hooked on government sort of subsidies for six generations. And there's people that think that they're still owed something to some extent. And I think the challenge is, and we mentally want to help people. But the challenge is, how do you do that and break that cycle of dependency and still sort of create the helping hand environment? And it's just a tough transition. And it's only been, you know, part of a generation that this has been going on. And I think we're going on the right path, but it's painful as it happens.
It seems though you're more about investing and, you know, giving people the skills to help themselves rather than the old idea of charity. This isn't charity.
Well, you can never give somebody enough money to if they don't help themselves, right? And what's crazy is, like, in Sioux City, I'm considered amongst my friends, like, wildly liberal, you know? I mean, I'm just, I told somebody I went to an East Coast liberal institution. Like, I just, you know, that's what they say on TV. And, but in Winnebago, I'm totally like Ronald Reagan or something. Yeah, but because I'm like, hey, we've got to get a job. We've got to get educated. And I don't just say it. I try to help create the jobs. I try to help do the scholarships or push people. You know, it's just one of those kinds of things that is super important to our psyche and our world in terms of helping our families and tribal members. It's like being a part of a super club.
I know another one of your enthusiasms is this idea of new urbanism. And in your project in South Sioux City, that you're going to try and make it very livable, walkable.
Yeah. You know what's strange is I have a place in Omaha, in the Old Market. And right, I walked by a place called Activate Omaha, or Active Living Omaha. And I walked into their office and said, hey guys, how's it going? I'm Lance. And they said, you would not know this, but in 2002, I was on the board of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and Nebraska got two grants. You know, there was only like 14. Nebraska got two, one for the reservation and one for Omaha. And Omaha's done all these things like bike lanes and things like that. But I was the advocate for Omaha to create sort of a pedestrian environment. And so I just, they sort of updated me, but we did the same thing in Winnebago. We built a walkable community. Diabetes is such a problem in our world. So and our housing was government built, and it's sort of fraction. There's a little piece over here and a piece over there, and no one walked anywhere. And we wanted to create not just where you go to the gym. We wanted to create an environment where your kids could play in the street. You know, you could ride your bikes, you could walk to the store, you could do that sort of thing. And just to create a healthy, safe environment. And I think that that's what people want. And what we're trying to do in Sioux City and what we're trying to do in South Sioux City with our design is to create more of an urban landscape. And Sioux City's got a lot of it already. I think what we're doing at Virginia Square and on Pearl Street will help. But South Sioux City is going to be a straight-up new urbanism community with, you know, front porches and garages in the back and alleyways and streetscapes and lots of green space. We won the regional award for urban planning out of seven states last year for that project. And so I think it's going to be something unique to Sioux City, and that's what people like.
20 years ago in Sioux City, I don't think people thought that the city would be in sort of a forward-moving direction that it's in right now. I think things have changed a lot. Is that how you see it?
Well, when I first came here, I sort of, you know, I wasn't married, but I had a girlfriend, and she said, "You've got to be kidding me." You know, she was from California, and then we lived in Minneapolis. And it took about 6 months for her to come here. She goes, "The town that smells bad," and I was like, "Yeah, you know, I'd appreciate if you came." and I was always sort of an outsider. But as an outsider, I've now lived here longer than any place else, so I don't consider myself an outsider anymore. But I sort of watched the community, and it seemed to me that there was a lot of people here. There was money here. You know, there was some wealthy people. But I think when you get rich, you get conservative, right? And so what happened was there wasn't a vitality going on, and that capital was here, but it wasn't being invested aggressively. And it doesn't take many people to do that. And I think that what you're seeing emerge here, and we're part of that, there's other people doing it too, is a willingness to invest in Sioux City and to do some of the things that other cities have done already. Sioux Falls has a revitalizing downtown, Lincoln, Des Moines, certainly Omaha. And if we're going to attract and keep that sort of younger you know, a person, then we're going to have to really push the envelope there. Sioux City produces smart people. They just don't have job opportunities here and stay. And we've gotten hammered a few times with Terra leaving and Gateway leaving. And so creating that, and but that's always what we're going to need to do. Otherwise, we're going to be like sort of a worker place for big companies. We'll provide low-cost workers for factories or something. And that's okay if your economy is going to be based on Walmart. But if you want to create a dynamic environment, you have to create, you know, high-tech, white-collar sort of jobs. And that's what we're missing. But if you're going to do that, you sure as heck better have some of the amenities that they want in a community, because younger people will just move, you know, and they'll come back to Sioux City to visit their parents at Christmas. Right. And so I think that Sioux City has got that going, and the more stuff we can do, the better. And what's hard about that is that the economic demographics don't work well for sort of high-end downtown stuff. And so we're taking a bit of a risk in doing that. It's sort of a build it and they will come. But we're hoping that it'll happen. We're making sort of an all-in bet on the economy of Sioux City. And I hope it works out, to be honest. And I think it will.
Yeah, me too. That was Lance Morgan, president and CEO of Ho-Chunk Incorporated. Morgan has invested a lot of time and money into improving opportunities for his people in higher education. In Iowa, the state legislature has passed some cuts to Regents universities and community colleges to deal with a $110 million budget shortfall. Community colleges lost $3 million in state funding. A recent study released by the Iowa Department of Education shows that community colleges are actually a bargain. They give back a high return for the state's investment. Jeremy Varner of the Iowa DOE says the community colleges collectively in Iowa have contributed $5.4 billion to the economy.
And we're really pleased with the results of the study. It confirms Iowa's community colleges expand opportunities not only for students, but they're also important drivers of the state's economy, training students for businesses and important industries in regions throughout the state, and generating a wide range of social benefits.
Could you talk a little bit about what it does, first of all, for the students in terms of their economic future?
Studying at an Iowa community college generates a significant return for students. It helps them move into middle-skill careers or on to further study at four-year colleges and universities. And so for every dollar that a student invests in Iowa's community colleges, they receive a return on investment of $6.50. And so basically what that means is they have future earnings throughout their careers that are higher than they would have if they had not enrolled in an Iowa community college.
What about for the state economically?
Right. So there's a few different ways to look at the economic impact for the state. I think the most important one is probably the impact for taxpayers. And so Iowa's community colleges have a significant footprint, but by training students and filling important jobs in the economy, students, the workers in Iowa earn more and generate an economic impact for the state, and reductions in things like social benefits, public funded programs that might otherwise have a burden. And so the taxpayers receive a significant return on investment. Beyond that, looking at just simply our community college as a whole, the community colleges employ people, they have large budgets, and they have alumni throughout the state that are significant in terms of their impact on the state's economy. Mm-hmm. So they have a very significant impact that's manifested in that, or described in that report.
The benefits of a community college education go a lot further than we might have thought.
Right. So this study articulates in a clear way and with data much of what we know, which is that our community colleges have a very significant impact, not just on the students, but on the businesses in our communities and on the state as a whole by building taxpayers who are going to have higher earnings, pay more taxes, and contribute more to society generally. So this is all quantified in the report and described in a great deal of detail, which is helpful for us in understanding those various impacts.
how might it inform decisions that are made about supporting community colleges? Is this the kind of thing that you might hand over to community college presidents, to legislators?
Certainly. So one of the department's roles is to describe our system of community colleges and education more broadly. And so we generate a wide range of reports that describe for policymakers and the public exactly what's going on, what programs do, how they work. And this report fits within that context. So we expect education leaders, policymakers, and others to better understand our system and and the impacts that it has as a result of this report and other reports.
I know maybe this is not part of this report, but do you ever do studies about the effects on I'm not saying this the right way. I was reading something about inclusiveness and diversity, trying to get that to do it better in community colleges. Do you ever see any studies on that, how community colleges are doing in terms of diversity and inclusiveness? And it might not be what you do, but
no, absolutely. We absolutely do. We talked a little bit about that with our Condition of Community Colleges report that we released here about a month ago. So we certainly track by institution and as a system student diversity, student demographics, and issues related to that, as well as for staff and faculty and other sort of associated issues. And we have some initiatives that actually try to address some of those challenges funded by either state or federal funds. And so those are important issues. They're not explicitly addressed by this study, which looks at, you know, this larger economic impact of our institutions and of students that go through them and whatnot. But yes, we do study those, and we do have projects and programs that directly try to address issues with, for example, non-traditional student enrollment in certain kinds of programs that may not have those or areas where there are lack of diversity. So absolutely, it's something we pay attention to and are actively working to address.
Was there anything in this study that was particularly surprising to you?
You know, it's not the first time we've done this kind of study. So there's nothing that I guess was shocking. It is impressive, no matter how many times you look at it, to see the scale of the economic return, right? When you look at it, they are very large numbers. And the impact is very significant, both for students and for businesses and for the state. And so anytime you look at that, it is a staggering impact and helpful to see and quantified in a very direct way.
Yeah, so thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Sure, I'm happy to help. I appreciate the call and your interest.
I know you have three really excellent speakers this year. Can you tell me about them?
Jeffrey Tobias Halter is a strategic planner and strategist in major corporations, started out in Coca-Cola, but has helped many organizations understand how you leverage talent within an organization. He will be here, and he will be speaking both to the general public and also to the CEO Forum. And the CEO Forum is for all the sponsored membership people that can come and ask questions and kind of talk about, get on the table, the need to leverage both men and women and the reasons behind why that's important and how it will help their businesses. And then we have Sally Krawcheck. And Sally Krawcheck is, she's coming off of Wall Street, and she, every member who attends, every woman who attends will receive the book, Own It, Women at Work. And it's kind of a follow-up to what Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, was maybe 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so she's just a dynamic speaker, CEOs of Barney Smith and Merrill Lynch and Citibank and you name it, you know. So she's going to be challenging us. And then we have Carrie Lorenz. And Carrie Lorenz is the first female Tomahawk fighter pilot in the USA Navy. So that's our inspirational speaker who will put on the table ways to encourage women to go out and make a difference, go out and be who you want to be.
What kind of challenges do you think women in particular have when it comes to developing leadership skills?
I think belief in themselves is one of the first.
Mm-hmm.
Belief that they don't have to be perfect in order to advance.
And women hold themselves, I think, to a very high standard. And that confidence needs to start being built very young. We see the difference, the gender differences, and that's the reason that I feel this conference is so important for our young women to attend, to hear other people who, how they achieve their confidence was just putting yourself out there and doing it and becoming involved. I think that's one of the major themes of this conference.
There's also, of course, because there's wherever you get women, you got networking happening. Mm-hmm. And we focus on that, especially at the noon luncheon area, where we really have some networking experiences go place. And I think that's what our young women also need, is the mentoring of other women, older women, mm-hmm. Women who are out there planning and doing it and things. And so I think the networking is also a part of the growth of our young women, college women.